From NPR and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Chemical weapons investigators said today they don't know when they're going to be able to gather evidence in the Syrian town of Douma. That's where the U.S., the U.K., and France say the Syrian government used poison gas to kill more than 40 people earlier this month. The head of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said that when they tried to enter Douma, there was gunfire and a bomb blast that kept them from accessing the site. The governments of Syria and Russia deny using chemical weapons. Alistair Hay is a chemical weapons expert at the University of Leeds. Professor, you've investigated at the site of past chemical attacks, including Saddam Hussein's use of sarin against Kurds in Iraq in the 1990s. So what are the key questions that you have for inspectors hoping to access the site in Syria?
Well, I would want the OPCW inspectors to have unfettered access to everything that they think is important, that is victims, witnesses, and to be able to take the samples that they think are crucial. And I hope that there hasn't been any tampering with the evidence, but these are well-trained inspectors, and they will recognize when things are not right.
Well, you know that Russian and Syrian government forces took control of the area soon after the suspected chemical attack. So when you say that you would not want any evidence to have been tampered with, whether or not there was a deliberate attempt, do you think there's any way, since so much time has elapsed, that what's there could provide any help to the inspectors?
Yes, certainly. Work I did in Iraq years ago, as you mentioned, showed the presence of sarin in a crater where a bomb had exploded 4 years after the sarin had been released. So the inspectors, if it is a very potent nerve agent, for example, that might have been used, they will find that evidence in the environment. They will also, at this juncture, even possibly be able to find something in victims as well, if they get blood and urine samples. But certainly, talking to people who have been exposed and to the doctors who are treating them will provide a lot of confirmatory evidence.
When you go to a scene of a chemical attack or a suspected chemical attack, what's the mindset? Is it that you go in looking for evidence of sarin gas use, that you go looking for chlorine gas, that you look for anything? I mean, is there any limit to your remit?
No. They go in with an open mind. They would want to see if they could find munitions, because munitions often have high concentrations of agents, but they also have markings on them, and the type of munitions helps trace it back to a source as well. So they are open-minded, and it's only when they look at the evidence that they will come to a conclusion about what was used.
You say they can look at markings on munitions to trace them back to a source. Is that part of what the inspectors are doing? They're not just determining the presence of a chemical, but also where it came from, and I suppose by telling where it came from, who did it?
Well, OPCW never actually says who did it, but they provide as much evidence as they are able to glean from a scene. So they can describe the trajectory of a particular munition. They will describe that. They will describe what they find. They will photograph it. They record absolutely everything they do, so there is no dispute. And samples are then secured so that there's no possibility of anybody tampering with them. So the OPCW is open about all of this, but explicit about what it finds.
And so it does not assign blame. That's correct?
That's correct. The OPCW has a remit to say what was used and where it was used. You need some other mechanism for apportioning blame. There was a mechanism previously. That Joint Investigations Mission no longer exists because Russia vetoed the extension of the mandate in November last year. So there is no mechanism at present for apportioning blame of chemical attacks in Syria. We only will find out what was used and where it was used.
Which is important because Syria joined the Chemical Weapons Convention in 2013, was supposed to have given up its entire chemical weapons stockpile. Do we have evidence, even separate from this investigation, that it has done that?
No. And all of the evidence suggests that Syria has probably not got rid of everything. Unfortunately, chlorine, which Syria has used as a weapon in the past, is not something that is prohibited as a chemical that a country can have, because you need it for all sorts of uses, you know, for purifying water, for example. But as for sarin and the materials that Syria uses to make sarin, The country should have declared those, and those stocks should have gone in 2014. So there are questions about that. But I have to say the OPCW has had repeated questions for Syria about its compliance with the Chemical Weapons Convention and with its declarations that it's got rid of all of its stocks. And these have gone on since Syria joined the convention in 2013.
How independent are the inspectors?
Oh, this is their virtue. OPCW is completely neutral in all of this. It is representing 192 states, so it's there to provide objective evidence, and it is not really answering to anybody, if you like, or any individual state, but answering to all.
Alistair Hay, chemical weapons expert and professor emeritus of environmental toxicology at the University of Leeds. Very nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board are in Philadelphia today. They're hoping to figure out why an engine on a Southwest Airlines plane, a Boeing 737, blew apart in midair, shattering a window and nearly pulling a passenger outside. That passenger later died from her injuries. It's the first passenger death in a U.S. airline accident since 2009. That agency's chair, the National Transportation Safety Board chair, Robert Sumwalt, pointed to one possible cause of the engine failure, what he called metal fatigue. Andy Pastor is a senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal. He's covering this story, and he joins us now. Andy, welcome back to Here and Now.
Nice to be with you.
Andy, what does the NTSB chair mean by metal fatigue, and what may have caused this engine to fail?
He meant that a fan blade from the engine ruptured and broke off, spinning at very high speed at normal cruise altitude because of a weakness in the metal and the attachment to the hub of the engine. This could be a manufacturing issue. It could be a fatigue during normal operations that just wears the metal down. And so that's the cause of the problem. But the root cause, that is why it occurred, is what the NTSB is going to be looking at. In addition to that, they're going to be looking at inspection procedures by Southwest to see if ultrasound checks were done on some engines and should have been done on this specific engine prior to the accident.
Well, let's look at whether inspections should have been done. The NTSB is also looking, I understand it, at another engine failure in 2016, also on a Southwest jet. No one was hurt then, but the engine from that incident was made by the same company. Is there an inspection failure going on here?
Well, I think this is one of the big questions that needs to be answered. The 2016 incident is eerily similar to what happened on Tuesday, and the manufacturer recognized that there was an issue and recommended that its operators of these engines do ultrasound checks. Now, these recommendations are non-binding. They're not mandatory, and typically the FAA quickly follows up with a mandatory safety directive ordering airlines to do whatever the manufacturer initially recommended. In this case, the FAA didn't make the inspections mandatory. It was within weeks of making them mandatory, I understand, prior to the accident. So one focus will be on why the FAA didn't move perhaps as quickly as it should have. And a second focus is the way the engine broke apart. It appears that the front cover or cowling disintegrated or parts came off of it. And so that's another issue that investigators are looking at.
Southwest has said it'll inspect planes with similar engines over the next 30 days. Are those planes safe to fly right now?
Well, I think the margin of safety may be not quite what it was before this accident, because clearly there's some questions about when the inspection should be done. Now, we should note that the inspections, whether recommended by the manufacturer or ordered by the FAA, still would have taken many months to complete. So, in fact, Southwest has speeded up that process. It's also interesting to note that about a decade ago, Southwest got into serious trouble with the FAA and with congressional investigators for skipping some structural inspections of parts of their fuselage on about four dozen older 737 airliners. It became a very big issue, and it really gave Southwest a black eye at that point. And I think Gary Kelly, the chairman and chief executive now, who was there during the earlier, I would say, public relations crisis, Mr. Kelly is trying to figure out a way to ensure that the airline comes across in a better public relations stance this time.
Andy, briefly, how common are serious engine problems in the airline industry like this?
Well, with modern jet engines, increasingly they are increasingly safe, and such events, which are called uncontained engine failures, meaning that internal rapidly spinning parts actually exit the engine cover and the casing and can penetrate the fuselage or damage the wing, those kind of events are extremely rare. Engine problems in general are not one of the main safety issues that U.S. airlines and airlines in other developed parts of the world face. Engines are very reliable. That's why this accident has caused such a big stir, because it's very unusual, and the way the engine ruptured and came apart is also not typical.
Andy Pastor is a senior special writer with the Wall Street Journal. He covers aviation. Andy, thank you.
You're welcome.
The White House confirmed today that CIA chief and Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo secretly met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week in preparation for talks between Trump and the North Korean leader by early June.
And on Twitter this morning, President Trump contradicted himself on why he fired FBI Director James Comey last year. This morning, Trump wrote, "Slippery James Comey, the worst FBI director in history, was not fired because of the phony Russia investigation." But last year, Donald Trump told NBC News that the Russia investigation was indeed on his mind when he fired Comey. Let's bring in Here and Now political strategist to sort it all out for us, John Raybender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. And Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Hello, Jamal.
Hello. How are you?
Good. John, you first. James Comey went on Stephen Colbert's show on CBS last night, and Colbert asked him about the president's tweets.
Anything to say back?
No, he's tweeted at me probably 50 times. I've been gone for a year. I'm like a breakup he can't get over. He wakes up in the morning.
So, John, plenty of Democrats and plenty of Republicans, too, are angry at James Comey for different reasons. How much does that blunt the bigger points that he's making in his new book?
I think it blunts it a lot. I mean, you had newspapers like the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette call him a vaudeville act at this point. I think people realize that he is doing very petty type of criticisms of the president that's unseemly of somebody coming out of law enforcement. I think they believe he's just trying to hawk some books. Honestly, I think James Comey has probably hurt James Comey more than he has the president on this book tour that he's on.
Jamal, what do you think?
I think that we can't get lost, can't get the forest lost for the trees. People are focusing on this small little point. And again, he is trying to sell books. But the reality is that Jim Comey is the former FBI director. He was one of the people who really worked with President George W. Bush. He's not a Democrat. And he has said that he does not think that Donald Trump is fit for the office of the president. Now, I don't think the FBI is a perfect institution. I can give you a litany of things why I think, you know, in history where they got things wrong. But I do think it's worth taking into account that both the FBI director, we have a former CIA director, we have a myriad of officials who all come to the same conclusion that Donald Trump is not fit for office.
Well, look, but I think you can be critical and say he's not being fair to Donald Trump. But I want to argue that he's also not being fair to Hillary Clinton. One of the bombshells that came out was the acknowledgement that he actually was looking at poll numbers in deciding whether he was going to pursue Hillary Clinton, in late October, right before the election, and announced that they had reinvested the investigation. Now, we'll never know, and I don't think probably in my professional opinion that altered the election. But if I'm Hillary Clinton, if I'm her campaign, I'm sitting there for my rest of my life and thinking this is the ultimate irony. The reason we lost is because that Comey had made the decision that he thought we were going to win.
I'm not sure that John's making this point right now, but this really is a burr in my saddle. When the president goes after Jim Comey for going after Hillary Clinton as if that was something that was going to help Hillary Clinton, or instead it helped Donald Trump get into office. You can't have it both ways. He can't both be against Hillary Clinton and be against Donald Trump and try to say that he's on one side.
Let's turn to the Mueller investigation a little bit, if I might. What about if Donald Trump takes the bold step of firing this special counsel, Robert Mueller, as he's apparently considered? Last week, potential Democratic presidential hopeful and California Senator Kamala Harris got ahead of potential rivals and said firing Mueller would be grounds for impeachment. Jamal, is that a risky move and strategy? For Democrats.
For Kamala Harris? No.
For Democrats.
I don't think so. Listen, I think Democrats ought to be running on holding President Trump accountable. You can decide as an individual person if you want to use the impeachment word or not, but absolutely holding this president accountable is what is animating the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who have been on the streets since last January 21st.
Well, a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll out today shows that when you use the I word, voters are not so impressed. 47% of registered voters say they'll definitely vote against a candidate who wanted to impeach Trump. John, your response to that?
Well, first of all, I was very much on the record that I thought it was a mistake to try to impeach Bill Clinton over personal conduct. And what we're finding more and more is that it seems like they are not coming up with anything in the Mueller investigation. So now we've moved it to the investigation of the president's attorney to try to find something that is more relevant to only conduct of the president's side. I think that most Americans are pretty smart at this. I think they look at it and say, under this president, we might not always agree with his style, tone, and even actions, but our economy has taken off. We now have ISIS on the run. We have historic event coming up with North Korea. I think most people are starting to look and saying, as far as what the president is supposed to be concentrating on doing, he's doing a pretty darn good job at it.
We also have lots of porn stars and, random characters from the president's past who keep popping up. And it's hard for Americans to even watch the news with their children with this president in office.
We have the United Nations and Russia very much at issue this week as well. The White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow apologized to the U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley after he implied that she was confused about Russia sanctions that she said the Trump administration was soon going to implement, but then the president apparently backtracked on. So she pointedly told Fox News, with all due respect, I don't get confused. And here's what Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer had to say about that.
If I were Nikki Haley, I'd really be embarrassed. There is just no one home in terms of making consistent, strong policy when it comes to Russia. The staff seem to want to go in one direction. The president keeps pulling them back. And that is very bad for the country.
John and Jamal, I'd like to hear from you both on this briefly. What do you think is going on here with Haley and Donald Trump and Russia sanctions, which appear like they're not going to happen, at least not increased sanctions? Jamal?
Well, you know, the president did this already once before. It's interesting Larry Kudlow took after Nikki Haley for this, for saying she was confused. On Larry Kudlow's first day, he said the president was going to Latin America, and 30 minutes later we found out that he wasn't going to Latin America. The president doesn't consult with generals when he talks about Syria. I'm not sure he's consulting with all of his trade officials when he thinks about whether or not we're going to get back into TPP or not. The administration does not have any level of coordination that resounds in sound and orderly policymaking, and that confuses both Americans and our allies abroad.
Well, I would argue that this president particularly takes bold action and does what he absolutely thinks and doesn't just rely upon the people that he listens to. In other words, Syria, for example, learned very quickly that this president wiped out their chemical capabilities to have any more chemical attacks against children and anybody else in Syria. I think on Russia, what this president is trying to say is we are going to have the same type of thing. When it's appropriate, we are going to expel 60 people like we did, 60 Russians. When it's appropriate, we'll take the right steps. But I think he is right in saying we got to be careful with Russia. It's never going to be a perfect relationship, but we have so many common enemies like ISIS and others that we need to try to have a relationship. And he has said a number of occasions that he has said to Putin that do the right thing and act like you should with the other countries, and let's have a relationship that could result in world peace and some significant progress. But I think the president is running out relative to Russia.
The U.S.-Russia car seems to be the only one the president drives with his foot on the brake. I think we all are wondering why.
Also this week, there was the surprise announcement that the CIA director, Mike Pompeo, who's in line to be Secretary of State, if he's confirmed, had a meeting at a very high level in North Korea last week. It happened before the Japanese prime minister got to his pitch for diplomacy at Mar-a-Lago with the president this week. John, what do you make of that? I mean, sort of parallel universe in the White House here or shrewd diplomacy?
Well, I would certainly put it. I mean, this was the highest ranking meeting between United States and North Korea since the year 2000. And I think that that is extremely significant. I think it's important because what it really symbolizes is that the talks coming up sometime before June are going to be substantive, not just for PR reasons. And I think this is how you do set the groundwork for coming out of that with something constructive. And, you know, I think Mike Pompeo, most people would agree, let's not forget, when he was confirmed as CIA director, it was with significant support by Democrats as well. And even people like The Washington Post have talked about the importance of Mike Pompeo. So I think he was the right person to send at the right time before these important talks.
Any concern that Trump, who, of course, didn't campaign as an overseas president, could be drawn further into overseas conflicts, negotiations? We've got Syria, we've got North Korea, we've got other overseas events. John, quickly.
Well, I think the president signaled in Syria that we're staying there until ISIS is out, but he wants countries like Saudi Arabia to start doing bigger and more things rather than everything always being dependent upon America.
Yeah, and I'm not upset with the president for engaging the world. I'm upset with the president for not engaging the world with any consistency and understanding about geopolitical endeavors that will make America safer. I think the North Korea gambit seems like it's starting to pay off. I will give him credit if it works out because it's a very serious matter and we shouldn't play politics with it.
There's a lot of talk about whether the president or why the president is not engaging Congress when it comes to things like authorizing military strikes in Syria. How are Jamal non-interventionists and critics of Trump policy on both sides of the aisle dealing with this? And how is Syria seemingly scrambling the whole political calculus?
Well, again, the problem with the president's approach is nobody really understands the president's approach. It just seems as if he veers from one thing to another. He doesn't consult his team so that they understand what's happening. He's not in regular coordination with our allies. And then because he's for something today, he could be for something else completely tomorrow. And he doesn't tell the truth, as James Comey said in his book. So it's hard for us to know what to grade the president on because he's always on his own curve.
John Brabender is a Republican strategist. Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. We're out of time. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire.
We're getting an idea of just how much the Republican tax cuts are helping American banks. Morgan Stanley announced a record first quarter profit today of $2.67 billion. That's up 40% from a year earlier. Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America have also reported huge quarterly profit jumps. All these banks saw their tax bills drop dramatically after the Republicans signed tax cuts into law in December. Emily Glazer is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, joins us now from Culver City, California. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Lisa.
Remind us how much taxes tumbled for these banks because of the Republican tax bill.
The corporate tax rate was at a high of 35%, and under the new tax law, we've seen banks have tax rates around 20%, in some cases closer to 18%.
Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren said earlier this year then the banks are the big winners from the tax law, not workers. But Republicans have argued the banks will give that money to workers or invest it. So what are the banks doing with the money?
Dozens of banks have said that they will raise wages for lower-level employees or even offer bonuses to employees before and since the new tax law passed. In some cases, that just amounts to a fraction of what the banks earn overall. But in other cases, especially the largest U.S. banks, have said they're making huge investments, whether it's opening up hundreds of new branches, doing more investment in digital and mobile capabilities or other kind of ways to grow their businesses organically, which is a huge change from what we've seen in years past where banks were tightening the reins, paying regulatory settlements. There's a lot more optimism and potential for growth in large part because of this new tax law.
Meanwhile, stocks have been way up and way down and up and down again recently. With that kind of volatility in the markets, what does that mean for the banks?
That's a great way to put it. We see them up, we see them down. Overall, though, banks have generally been very fortunate in the markets. The sector has grown tremendously. Banks continue to hit record after record after record in terms of their stock performance. I think the expectation of the tax law changes, additionally with rising interest rates, have boosted bank shares. You know, we have seen them taper off a little bit more recently. And what we saw with the earnings period these past couple of days, late last week through today with the largest U.S. banks, is that many investors have really raised the stakes. And even though banks have put out these huge growth numbers, the bank stocks didn't gain very much because now investors are thinking, you've got the corporate tax rate a lot lower. There's an ability to make a lot more money, and we expect even more now.
Emily, we've been talking about the big banks. How about smaller ones? Have they been doing well, too?
Yes, this definitely benefits the smaller ones, too. Although, when you say small banks, you know, there's the community banks who are maybe one or two branches, and then we often think of, like, the large regional banks. So when you think about U.S. Bank, BB&T, PNC, Fifth Third, those are all banks that have said they're planning to give or have given their employees wage increases after the U.S. tax law passed. And some of those banks have also announced investments in digital and mobile. So they're definitely benefiting as well.
Okay, thank you. Emily Glazer, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thank you.
Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner once called himself unelectable. Yet the 57-year-old attorney, known for being as outspoken as he is progressive, was sworn into office in January after winning the November election in a landslide. His platform was no less than reforming the criminal justice system, working to end mass incarceration, and taking responsibility for the fiscal realities of sentencing. Krasner's efforts are part of a national movement to fundamentally change the way we view justice in America, which currently has the highest incarceration rate in the world. District Attorney Larry Krasner joins us now from WHYY in Philadelphia. District Attorney Krasner, welcome.
Thank you, Eric.
Some have called your efforts nothing short of a criminal justice revolution. Do you see it that way?
I'm a lawyer. We don't know how to do revolution.
You say you don't do revolution, but you released a document of guiding policies, and the first sentence reads, "These policies are an effort to end mass incarceration and bring balance back to sentencing." That's an ambitious, tall order.
It is a tall order, but it's you know, essential. We have a country that seems to be, even now, unaware of the fact that it is the most incarcerated country in the world. You know, we have a system that makes apartheid look like they weren't locking up enough people compared to our standards. I mean, it's pretty ridiculous that we have had a 500% increase in incarceration nationally over a period of a few decades, and yet we find ourselves basically not safer with public schools that are bankrupted and with no treatment for a lot of the things that go to the roots of criminal conduct, such as addiction or lack of job training.
So are you trying to dismantle mass incarceration from the inside out?
Yes.
Tell me, in the first 100 days, what's been your biggest surprise in your effort to try to do that and your biggest roadblock? Is it bureaucracy? Is it inertia? What is it?
I mean, no offense to what it is that you do for a living, but I have to tell you, I think that media has, and not this media, but I think media in general has been engaging in a sort of a comic book tale ever since the era of William Randolph Hearst and yellow journalism. It's basically stories about fear with, you know, and it's stories about one side being all good and the other side being all bad instead of actually getting into the science and the nuance of it. People want to hear about the science. They want to hear about the nuance. They know that there are problems when they don't have public schools in a way that they did have 40 years ago.
Let's talk about the power of prosecutors, I mean, and plea deals, because the real world isn't like TV shows. 90% of cases plus end up with a plea bargain. Explain what you're asking your prosecutors to do these days to bring that number down to instill some more balance.
Well, we're doing, you know, we're doing quite a few things. There are a lot of cases that in the 1970s, frankly, would not have been prosecuted at all. And so we are trying to go back in that direction. There's a lot of cases that in the 1970s, if someone was charged, would have been turned into some kind of a diversionary program, meaning that people would have been held accountable but without a conviction. Everything changed, and somehow we started to consider any dispute to be worthy of criminal prosecution and arrest, and any arrest to be worthy of the highest charges and the highest form of incarceration. And part of what came with that was sentencing guidelines. In Pennsylvania, we have sentencing guidelines that have done nothing more than make Pennsylvania even more incarcerated than the rest of the country. We have a 700% increase in incarceration in Pennsylvania, and it is because a bunch of legislators, many of whom had never been lawyers nor had they ever been in criminal justice, were getting votes by preying off of fear and demanding high sentences. They are disastrous. And so I have instructed our prosecutors for cases that are not violent, don't involve sexual assault, things of that sort, to offer outcomes that are below the bottom end of these sentencing guidelines, which is legally permitted, and it's an appropriate use of discretion. But it also recognizes that these guidelines are the problem. They are part of why we have so many people in jail and we don't have public schools.
And so you're asking your prosecutors, you know, flip the script a little bit, start with the lowest possible, not the highest.
Well, I wouldn't say the lowest possible, but use your discretion to look at the case as an individual case involving unique people and figure out what is fair for an offense that is not that serious and is not violent. And what we have seen has been a rapid decline in the population of people in our county jails. Philadelphia, not long ago, had the most incarcerated county jails of any of the 10 largest cities. And it's now come down quite a bit. We are down from 8,000 people in our county jails to close to 5,000, which is quite an achievement.
Parole is another area, Mr. Krasner, where you're looking for big change. What's your overall policy goal there?
Well, unfortunately, once again, Pennsylvania is in some ways leading the nation in excessive long periods of probation and parole. There's a lot of research that shows that short periods of supervision have benefit, but the longer ones become an infinite series of hurdles that even a law-abiding person or someone who is reformed finds hard to overcome. For example, if you're working a job like you're supposed to, but you have to keep leaving work to go report to a probation and parole officer for years, it's harder to keep that job. For example, if they keep hitting you for $35 a month for year after year, you are, in all likelihood, if you're in the criminal justice system, a poor or working class person, there may come some months when you can't pay it. All of a sudden, you're back for a violation hearing, and all the things that you've built in terms of job and restoration with your family, things like that, can come to an end when you go back to jail.
One of the issues you're also grappling with as DA is money. You're asking prosecutors to sort of justify the cost of their sentencing, which you say is about $42,000 per inmate per year. But one retired prosecutor, Richard Sachs, called that absurd and said, this is insulting to the victims of crime. How do you respond to that?
Well, Mr. Sachs is just wrong. I mean, the truth is he's wrong. And he's got his fingerprints all over certain cases that indicate that he is from that old school that thought winning was everything. Winning was the only thing. We have always put a value on a case in terms of years of incarceration or months of incarceration. And that value corresponded to an amount of money we wouldn't talk about. This is simply more information, not less. It's not going to change the sentence on a truly heinous crime, but hopefully it will change the sentence on a case where there was over-incarceration, the homeless person who committed some sort of shoplifting, someone like that. Hopefully people will think twice before spending huge amounts of money to put that person in jail.
How do you start to change the sort of tough-on-crime, winning-is-everything attitude among some prosecutors who may not work for you? Do you think you'll have an impact outside of Philly?
Well, you know, I think the younger generation actually really understands these issues. And I see that as they come out of law school and as I speak to them and as they send, you know, frankly, one resume after another from really strong candidates for jobs. They have grown up with DNA proving that innocent people end up in jail. They've grown up with an understanding that mass incarceration is not only a huge problem for a society that claims to be free, but it's also racist. These are discussions they've had and that they're willing to have. So I feel like we are actually very strong among a lot of the prosecutors. Some of the older ones, I mean, let's be honest, it's hard to look back on your career and think that you were doing a good thing by stuffing so many people of color in jail. It's hard to look back on that and say, I guess I dedicated my life to doing something that's kind of negative. But it's the truth, and it's something that they have to face. And the ones who are willing to face it and then move in a positive direction will do so. And the ones who are not are just going to double down.
Are you hearing from other DAs? Is this a model or an anomaly in Philly?
No. I think there's a very strong national movement in major cities. We see it in Chicago with Kim Fox. We see it in San Francisco with George Gascon. We see it in Brooklyn with Eric Gonzalez. We see it in many other locations. There's a very, very strong movement of progressive DAs who are going the same direction, which is away from mass incarceration toward reinvesting resources that got hijacked for corrections into the things that actually prevent crime.
I want to ask you about what's being called the Starbucks arrest. I mean, two black men sitting peacefully in a Starbucks. They say they were waiting for a third friend to arrive when they were arrested, and your office ultimately did not arraign them. What does that case say to you?
Well, you know, I know that currently there are investigations going on within the police department about the incident and potentially even about their own officers. And I mean, without talking about the case, I don't think there's any question that this is a country where there has been a disparate enforcement of the law and even social norms against poor people and against people of color, which are, as we all know, very overlapping groups. I don't think there's any question that the criminal justice system has been racist in various different ways and has been unfair to the poor. And all of that needs to change. To the extent I can change it, that's what I want to do.
We've been talking to Philadelphia's District Attorney Larry Krasner about criminal justice reform and sentencing. Mr. Krasner, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.
Thousands of Russian Muslim men went to Iraq and Syria to fight for the so-called Islamic State. Many took their families with them. Now ISIS has lost the vast majority of its territory, and many of those Russian men have been killed. Their wives and children, some of them anyway, have gone missing. That's left their relatives back in Russia desperate to find out what happened to them. The BBC's Tim Huell has been investigating the disappearances. He's in London. Tim, you say it's almost as if these Russian women and children in the Middle East have fallen into a black hole.
Iraq, for example, has provided no lists of any kind, either of the dead, people from IS families, or simply of the missing, or of the ones that are in jail. The one thing we do know is that 1,400 foreign women and children, foreign ISIS women and children, were said to be in a jail in Iraq. But again, absolutely no names. So this total silence for months and months at the end of last year. And then, amazingly, that silence was broken by a single voice message that got out to one woman in Moscow from her sister, who turned out to be in a secret jail in Iraq. And this is the message.
There are about 200 of us here, all Russian speakers. Why are they holding us prisoner?
So in that message, she's saying, there are 200 of us here. I can't stand it anymore. We're in terrible conditions. It's so cold. They don't even give us proper blankets. The story behind that message, that whispered message, is amazing. So more than 200 women and children, this message came out in December, had been held already for 4 months, basically, in a secret dungeon. Not even in official Iraqi government custody. They were being held by a single militia commander, a warlord, if you like. So I went to Iraq and I confronted that commander. It was all a slightly scary experience. He admitted that he'd been holding the women. He denied that they'd been in bad conditions. But the day before I finally met him or finally confronted him, the women had been moved again.
How did you even approach him? I mean, this is a person presumably who did not want anything to do with you and did not want to talk about the women who had been held. What did he say to you?
Well, absolutely. And it really was quite a difficult meeting to set up. Of course, I couldn't possibly say I wanted to go and see him about women that he was holding, because at that point, apart from certain people in the Russian government, and of course, some of these relatives in Russia, including obviously the woman who'd got the messages, no one knew that he was holding them. The commander couldn't possibly know that I knew. So, of course, you're absolutely right. I had to go by a very indirect route. This militia commander, he's the leader or one of the leaders of a particular small ethnic community there in Iraq. So I had to basically say I wanted to see him in order to talk about how his community had suffered under IS, because they were a particular target, really, of IS violence. So only halfway through the interview, I suddenly changed subject and looked him in the eye and said very firmly, "So you're holding 200 women and children. Why are you holding them, and can I see them?"
And he said they'd been moved?
He admitted, I mean, he was obviously very shocked that I knew. He admitted he had been holding them. But the night before I did that interview, it seems under Russian government pressure, they had finally been moved from his custody, which they'd been in for the previous 6 months by that point, into an official Iraqi government jail. Although I have to say, what we know since then is that the conditions in that official jail are even worse, and even now no names have been given out. So in all this time, and we're now talking 8 months since IS was finally defeated in Iraq, the only names that we know of Russian women and children who have gone missing there, the only names came from these secret voice messages that were smuggled out. From official channels, nothing.
Why would they want to hold these women and children?
Well, that's a very good question, and we didn't get a straight answer. One of the extraordinary things that was in the voice messages, at one point, one of the women who was sending these messages said, the only time in 4 months that we've been allowed out of these two rooms, this cell, these cells, if you like, into the open air, is when we were paraded in front of a group of Iranian men who videoed us, and we believe that the plan was to sell us into prostitution in Iran. I obviously put that to the militia commander who was holding them. He denied that. He tried to laugh it off. You know, so whether that's true or not, I cannot say. I mean, we're talking obviously here about a mainly Shia militia. In other words, certainly a fighting force that has close links with Iran. But whether that's true or not, I just don't know. But there's no denying that, you know, for 200 foreign citizens to be held, not in government custody, but effectively in private custody for 6 months, is an extraordinary thing to happen.
The BBC's Tim Huell in London. Thanks so much, Tim.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.